West Legal Aid Center, who welcomes you to Does Force Majeure Force Business Interruption? To send a question to the presenters, type in the box below the Participation tab. Program materials can be found under your Supplements tab. It's my pleasure to introduce our panel, Johanna Sheehy and Thasian Jordan. I will turn the floor over to them now for further introductions.
Thank you so much and good afternoon. Again, my name is Joanna Sheehy and I am joined today by Thasian Jordan. And we would like to welcome you to our program, This Force Majeure, Force Business Interruption. To start with a few introductions, I am an attorney located down in sunny Miami, Florida. I work for Sheehy & Associates Law Firm, and my practice is focused on commercial litigation, insurance defense, and equine law. And I'm particularly excited about our topic today, as the issues that we're going to explore routinely come up for small and large business owners, and they have a particular relevance due to the ongoing pandemic and supply chain shortages that the world is experiencing right now. And I'm going to turn it over briefly now to Thasian to introduce herself.
Thank you, Joanna. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Thasian Jordan. I have been a licensed attorney in the state of Florida for over 7 years. I am the managing attorney at the Jordan Legal Group, located downtown Miami, Florida, where we devote a portion of our practice to providing operations management and contractual guidance to small businesses, investors, and entrepreneurs across leading industries. Today, I'm joined with Joanna as we discuss the various and ongoing issues with force majeure contract provisions in the context of COVID-19. And I will turn it over again to Joanna to go ahead with the program notes.
Thank you, Thasian. One programming note before we start. I want to let New York attorneys that will be seeking CLE credit know that you will need to provide a code to receive that credit. So about halfway through this presentation, I will read this code to you twice. Now, we are only permitted to read the code twice, so please make sure that you have a pen handy to write it down. Now, we'll go ahead and get started. Today, we are going to discuss force majeure and business interruption insurance in the context of COVID-19. First, Thasian is going to get us started with a discussion of force majeure. She is going to provide an overview of force majeure, including a discussion of triggering events and causation, and then discuss how courts have addressed force majeure in the context of COVID-19. Then I'm going to pick up and discuss business interruption insurance, first providing an overview of this coverage, and then delving into how claims and coverage disputes related to COVID-19 are being analyzed by the courts. If you have any questions along the way, you can feel free to submit them to us through that chat box feature. And we will try to answer those questions during or after our presentation. But if we do not answer them, please feel free to email those questions to us. The information packet that was provided to you does contain our email addresses, and we'd be happy to continue the discussion offline. So with that being said, I'm going to hand things over to Thasian to start things with force majeure.
Thank you, Joanna. Well, let's jump straight into the material. What is force majeure? Force majeure is a contract provision that relieves contracting parties from liability for failing to perform contractual obligations due to circumstances beyond the party's control. The concept of force majeure has a long outstanding history dating back to at least Roman times. And during Napoleonic years, it was adopted into French civil law, thereby migrating its way into English law. The English law concept of force majeure actually developed out of the common law doctrine of impossibility, and it has evolved over time. Now, force majeure clauses are intended to help parties avoid liability and potential costly litigation by spelling out the explicit events in which performance would be excused. The idea is that by anticipating future events, parties should be able to avoid litigating whether a specific event should suspend or excuse performance. Ideally, force majeure clauses are to provide greater certainty and understanding between the contracting parties. Because of this, historically, courts have narrowly construed force majeure clauses in litigation, meaning that only identified events listed or events similar to those listed in the language of the clause would be recognized as a quote-unquote covered event. So how does force majeure actually work? So basically, non-performance must be caused by a valid triggering event identified within the force majeure clause itself. And upon the determination that the triggering event caused non-performance, the standard of contract performance is analyzed to determine excused performance and released from liability. So let's dissect all of that for a bit. A well-drafted force majeure clause should contain four essential elements within the language of the clause itself. The first thing that your force majeure clause should address is an identifiable triggering event. Second, the effect of the triggering event on performance, which simply stated means causation. Third, the effect on contractual obligations, which is the standard of contract performance. And lastly, a notice requirement. Not only should your force majeure clause be comprised of these four elements, these four elements must also be successfully demonstrated by the party attempting to invoke force majeure. So let's briefly focus on each element. What is an identifiable triggering event? Well, the triggering event is the specific event or events actually listed within the language of the contract that excuses non-performance. They are considered what we call enumerated events because they are listed. Simple enough, right? However, I like to always tell my clients that not all contracts are equally created. And while a well-drafted contract should contemplate the possibility of unexpected events that could happen based upon the nature of the business of the contracting parties, every contract might not necessarily account for all events. So drafters often expand upon these enumerated events by including more broadly covered events, which could include expansive events related to the nature of the contract. They may want to include events that are considered what we like to call acts of God, which has been termed to be essentially nature or weather-related events. And drafters also should include catch-all provisions, which we all know are intended to cover all possibilities that are not covered by the individual terms of the contract. And although force majeure clauses usually end with a generic catch-all provision, it should be noted, and I want to make explicitly clear, that catch-all provisions or the interpretation of catch-all provisions are usually limited to the things of the same kind of nature as the enumerated events listed in the actual clause. So we don't want, you know, you to assume that just because you have a catch-all provision, it's going to include any and everything under the sun. It typically is interpreted to reflect what the contract consists of, or I should say the scope of the contract. So once an event has been determined to be an actual triggering event, your focus should then turn to the second element, which is causation. Is there a direct relationship between the triggering event and the actual contract performance? And if so, does the clause itself detail the effect that the triggering event has on performance? Now, every practitioner knows about the but-for test, which still remains at the forefront of determining causation. But for the existence of this event, would non-performance have occurred? So that remains at the forefront of determining whether or not your triggering event actually caused the non-performance. But what you want to particularly pay attention to, and this has also been, you know, at the center of litigation surrounding COVID-19, you want to pay attention to whether the force majeure clause indicates the effect the triggering event has on performance. And this is where contract law and common law principles intersect. Does the clause excuse performance only if performance is impossible, if it's merely impractical, or if it's inadvisable? Usually, however, the impossibility, contracts that state that performance needs to be impossible, that typically is what renders relief under a force majeure context. As a general rule of thumb, however, historically, impracticality and economic hardship alone has not been enough to excuse performance. And although, you know, especially given now in the current times, this is a tough position to be in, but courts continue to reaffirm this well-settled tradition throughout cases that have been litigated throughout the pandemic. So, economic hardship, and, you know, just because performance is impractical, it doesn't necessarily render relief under a force majeure clause. So courts have the tendency to really scrutinize this standard of contract performance. And more often than not, they're also going to look at or consider the intent of the parties at the time of contracting before making their ruling. Additionally, when analyzing contract performance or the effects of contract performance, I should say, courts also review the actual clause to determine whether the requested relief that the invoking party is seeking is expressly contemplated by the contract. So in other words, does the clause detail whether the contract will be fully terminated? Does it state whether the contract is, you know, should be just temporarily suspended or modified in any way in response to the triggering event? Also, are there any mitigating or alternative factors present that would allow for a continued or a modified performance? These are all things that courts consider when determining, you know, the effect that the triggering event has on performance or non-performance. Finally, and lastly, the fourth element, a well-drafted force majeure clause typically has a notice requirement, and it should have a notice requirement that the parties must comply with when invoking force majeure. For example, a force majeure clause may require that a party provide notice of the force majeure event to a specific individual, or written notice must be sent, you know, to a certain address by a certain mailing method or within a specific amount of time after the event occurs. So those are the four elements that your force majeure clause should contain. Now, once a party invokes force majeure and a dispute arises, what happened next? What happens next? So in pre-COVID times, courts would typically look at, you know, the terms of the contract first. And once they review the terms of the contract to determine if language is stated within the contract, you know, they will consider any common law defenses for non-performance, like, you know, impossibility, impracticality, frustration of purpose. They look at these things to determine if, you know, the invoking party is entitled to some relief from liability, if at all. Now, the specific language of the force majeure clause is analyzed like I said, alongside with the intent of the parties at the time the contract was made. And this is analyzed based upon the actual language of the contract. If the force majeure clause specifically includes the event that actually prevented performance, then performance will be excused. When a clause lists specific events that would excuse non-performance, then courts would typically exclude or excuse only the events that are specified. If a clause is worded more broadly or includes a catch-all phrase, then courts will look to the rest of the contract to determine the scope of the force majeure clause and will apply a greater scrutiny to the triggering event that is not specifically listed. Now, earlier I stated that catch-all provisions were usually limited to things of the same kind and nature as the scope of the contract or the enumerated events that are listed within the force majeure clause. Well, this comes from a doctrine called adjusdem generis, which basically means that general words are not given an expansive meaning, but rather they are confined to things of the same kind or nature as the particular matters mentioned in a non-exhaustive list. So traditionally, and by traditional, I mean pre-COVID, the principle allows for a stricter interpretation of the alleged triggering events that were not specifically enumerated within the language of the force majeure clause. Also, and this is more so true when the party is relying on a general catch-all provision, rather than a specifically enumerated event to invoke force majeure, courts will analyze whether the invoking party was negligent in any way, and often whether the force majeure event was not foreseeable. So that negligence and whether a party contributed to its own non-performance is also something that courts will typically consider prior to determining whether the invoking party is subject to the relief that they are actually requesting. So everything that I just previously mentioned with regard to, you know, the court's interpretation and how the catch-all phrases have typically been narrowly construed. These are things that have happened pre-COVID and how the courts have analyzed or handled force majeure clauses pre-COVID. Post-COVID, however, contract language, intent of the contracting parties, and the establishment of causation between the triggering event and non-performance, they still remain narrow. And it is still at the forefront of the court's analysis in determining relief from liability. However, what we are seeing is that courts have varied in the construction of force majeure provisions within the context of COVID-19. Now, generally, pre-COVID, there has typically been a dispute or a litigation that encompasses whether or not a triggering event is a triggering event within the context of the force majeure clause. Typically, like I previously stated, courts will look at the specific language of the contract to determine if the event that the plaintiff is alleging is first enumerated within the force majeure clause. If the alleged event is not enumerated, then you go to the more courts go look at the broader terms in the force majeure clause or look to the catch-all provisions in the force majeure clause to see if the alleged event falls within any of those categories. So generally speaking, post-COVID, disputes over whether or not COVID-19 constitutes a force majeure triggering event has not been of issue. And actually, in December of 2020, the Southern District Court of New York remarked that it cannot be seriously disputed that the COVID-19 pandemic is a natural disaster. So other courts have definitely ruled similarly that COVID-19 does constitute a natural disaster. And there have been some cases where, you know, attorneys have successfully argued that rather than arguing that COVID-19 is the triggering event, the government orders that stems from COVID-19, they have successfully argued that government orders were actually a triggering event within the context of a more broader force majeure clause, or, you know, something that would be considered in a catch-all provision. COVID-19, there's no dispute that it's definitely a force majeure triggering event. So rather than litigating over the event, the post-COVID trend now seems to be, or it seems to center specifically around causation and the requested relief that the invoking party is seeking, which essentially are just the effects of the triggering, the effects of triggering force majeure clause itself. So this ushers in more scrutiny as it relates to the actual contract language and the intent of the parties. Now, some states have analyzed catch-all provisions, like I said, more broadly to provide relief absent the contract language requiring strict impossibility as the standard of contract performance. For example, there was a bankruptcy court in Illinois last year that examined the governor's shutdown order as it related to restaurants, which the shutdown order specifically prevented patrons from sitting down and eating in the restaurants. However, it did permit restaurants to engage in carryout dining. But essentially, the part of the order that prevented patrons from sitting inside caused the invoking party's noncompliance. So the force majeure clause at issue, it didn't require strict impossibility, but rather the clause used terms such as delayed, retarded, or events that hindered performance to actually excuse non-performance. So the Illinois court determined that because the shutdown order actually hindered in-person dining, which constituted approximately 3/4 of the restaurant's square footage, the invoking party was actually entitled to some relief and was excused from 3/4 of its rental obligations. So this is an example of how courts have broadly used this catch-all language to allow invoking parties to seek relief. And even though some courts may have a more lenient or broad standard with respect to what falls within catch-all provisions, invoking parties, they still face the hurdle of establishing 100% causation and proving that the relief that they are requesting has actually or was actually contemplated by the parties at the time of contracting. So that still remains a hurdle, a big hurdle that plaintiffs have to overcome even in the context of COVID-19. Now, there have been at least 14 jurisdictions, and probably now since we're live here doing this presentation, there may be more jurisdictions that have provided some sort of guidance or have addressed force majeure within the context of COVID-19. And just a couple of examples, I chose cases that focus strictly on addressing causation and addressing remedies, because that's what it looks like the trends are. So by way of example, let's see here, the District Court of Massachusetts. You know, they ruled that difficulties making contractual payments and minimum purchases do not excuse performance without establishing that COVID-19 was the precipitating cause. And the Southern District of Florida, down here where Joanna and I are, the court ruled that a defendant must demonstrate that county regulations restricting non-essential business operations directly affected the ability to pay rent. And a little bit of relief, again, coming out of the bankruptcy court in Illinois. Although force majeure clause was unambiguously triggered by the executive government order, the triggering of the force majeure clause only partially excused rental obligation because the restaurant could have used at least 25% of space for pickup and delivery services. So that is another case that directly relates to the restaurant industry and awarding the restaurant partial relief in light of COVID-19 and government shutdown orders. Now, there have been cases, like I said, that have addressed the remedies that plaintiffs are seeking. In the District Court of Kansas in September of 2020, the court ruled that the plaintiff could not obtain a temporary restraining order to delay defendant's termination of a service agreement based on the force majeure clause because nothing in the service agreement allowed for stalling termination as a remedy of force majeure. So again, that's an example of the court looking to the language of the contract to determine whether or not the relief that the plaintiff is requesting has been contemplated by the parties in the drafting of the contract. Courts do not typically award relief outside of the scope of what the parties had anticipated or intended for at the time of contracting. Hawaii, the district court in Hawaii in June of 2020 refused to refund a deposit after contract termination based upon the contract's force majeure provision, is stating that it was not a breach of contract because there was no language in the contract that obligated the defendant to refund deposits based on a triggering event within the force majeure clause. And lastly, by way of example, the Supreme Court of New York actually awarded summary judgment and refund of full deposit in favor of the plaintiff, where government authority made it illegal or impossible for a defendant to hold an event, thus triggering the force majeure clause. Again, this is an example of how government authorities or government orders have specifically made it impossible for the parties to perform under the terms of a contract. So, overall, in the context of the post-COVID world, like I stated, plaintiffs still have to overcome the hurdle of causation and proving that the remedies that they're seeking are contemplated within the terms of the contract. However, we have seen some courts construe catch-all provisions a little bit more broad to award relief to the plaintiff, but only in the context of when the standard of performance of the contract is not an impossibility. So, like, these are just a few examples of how courts have, you know, ruled on the invocation of force majeure in the context of COVID-19. But what I want to focus on here is the bigger picture. Now, just as this last case that I mentioned in New York, the Edison Ballroom case, what happens now after it's been determined that the invoking party is successful in obtaining relief from damages? What's the bigger picture? Now, the triggering event that caused the inability for Edison Ballroom to perform, by way of example, is just one contract. I'm assuming that Edison Ballroom had several contracts. I'm assuming this case particularly was a wedding, and we all know that the wedding industry was hit huge or affected tremendously by COVID-19. But again, this is just one contract. I'm assuming this company has several contracts. So the trigger event in this one particular litigation still remains an impediment or an interruption to a company's overall business performance. So from a holistic approach, what happens when a business has been interrupted due to a force majeure triggering event? And this is where I'm going to turn it over to Joanna to talk about COVID-19 in the context of business interruption.
Thank you, Tejian. So many businesses, to address this exact circumstance, carry something called business interruption insurance. And before I move into my discussion on business interruption insurance, I need to pause and I need to note that I am now going to announce the code required for New York attorneys. So please get ready to record that code. In order to comply with New York regulations, attorneys looking for CLE credit in New York will need to be able to provide a code. This code is not intended for the West Legal Ed Center audience, either live or on demand. I will read this code twice and only twice. I cannot repeat it or email it to you, so please do make note of it. The New York State code number is J as in Joy, S as in Sam, 31302-111921. Again, the New York State code number is J as in Joy, S as in Sam, 31302-111921. Now, with that out of the way, I would like to pick back up with business interruption insurance. So what is business interruption insurance? At a high level of generality, business interruption insurance, which is also sometimes referred to as BI insurance, is an insurance policy that can help a business cover operating expenses and lost income if a covered loss forces that business to shut down. And the types of things that a BI policy can cover include lost revenue, fixed costs such as rent, and employee payroll, which, of course, as Tejian was just discussing, during the pandemic become incredibly important coverages to businesses across the country. Now, I will note that typically, to qualify for a policy of business interruption insurance, a business is actually required to have a commercial space. So oftentimes, this is going to exclude businesses that are operated out of a home office. And as we get deeper into our discussion, that will become apparent because of the requirements as to physical damage to the structure. But I just wanted to kind of point that out before we dive too deep into this. And like all insurance policies, BI policies are subject to exclusions. And we're going to talk about some of those exclusions, including a virus exclusion, as we move forward with this discussion. So if you have a policy of business interruption insurance, how is a claim triggered? Well, first, the business must experience a closure, a suspension, or a disruption. And business interruption insurance typically does not cover brief suspensions or slowdowns. Generally speaking, it's only going to cover events that stop operations over a significant period of time, which, of course, as we all know, definitely happened in the context of this pandemic. Now, often there's also going to be a waiting period, and it's sometimes referred to as a time deductible. Now, sometimes that can be a period of 24, 48, or 72 hours, but there usually is some type of a waiting period before your coverage is going to kick in. And again, that ties back to the the idea that this type of insurance is not designed to cover short suspensions or slowdowns. It's supposed to cover events that really stop operations over a significant period of time. Next, a closure must be caused by direct physical loss or direct physical damage. And these are terms which forms the crux of many coverage disputes. And we're going to talk about what these terms mean and how courts have interpreted them in the context of COVID-19. Because often with business interruption claims, there is some physical impact to the insured property, which halts business. Oftentimes, it's structural damage. Now, third, which seems a bit self-evident, there must be an actual loss of business income. Fourth, the closure must be caused by a covered cause of loss. In other words, the cause of the loss cannot be excluded. And as I said, in all policies, business interruption policies often contain exclusions and endorsements, which might limit or expand coverage depending on the particular language of that policy. Now, related to business interruption insurance, and relevant to our discussion today, is civil authority coverage. Now, this coverage will pay for business losses when a government bars access to an insured's property after damage to a property other than the insured's. And so the key here to this coverage is that the damage has occurred to another property. And concurrent with that, that access to the insured property has been denied. And we often see this with a catastrophic event. Access to business is often denied for safety concerns. And a common requirement for these claims is that the action of the civil authority prohibiting access to your property be due to direct physical loss or direct damage to the property other than the covered premises. So again, we're seeing that language, direct physical loss or direct physical damage, just like we see in the business interruption policies. And courts do interpret that language to be the same way, and they apply the same principles. And so before diving any deeper into the meaning of those terms, I want to pause briefly and discuss the general principles that are applied when interpreting the language of an insurance policy. So the key points here, general contract principles are utilized when interpreting insurance contracts. So terms are going to typically be given their ordinary meaning, and a policy will be typically construed as a whole. In other words, individual provisions are not going to be analyzed in a vacuum, but instead within the context of the larger policy, and the view of the policy will be to see it as a complete document. Now, there's also many interpreted rules that favor coverage, or in other words, favor the insureds. For example, ambiguity. Ambiguous terms typically are construed against the insurance company and in favor of the insured. When uncertain, an interpretation generally is going to be weighed in favor of coverage. And when a denial is based on an exclusionary clause, that exclusion is going to typically be read and construed narrowly. So with this framework in mind, let's turn our attention back to how business interruption insurance has come into play during the pandemic. Now, when the pandemic hit, many businesses were forced to close, either for safety concerns, because of government orders, or a combination of those things. And the result was a loss of business revenue and income and a flood of business interruption claims. Now, how did the carriers respond to this? Well, by and large, carriers denied coverage. And the basis of these denials varied. But one common thread that ran through many of these denials was the assertion that the direct physical loss requirement, which is set forth in the policies, required a physical alteration or structural damage to trigger coverage. And the carriers took the position that COVID-19 simply cannot cause that type of damage. And therefore, any economic damages that were caused by the virus could not trigger coverage. Now, of course, insured businesses often disagreed with this assessment. They would argue that COVID-19 did, in fact, impair property well within the meaning of the policy and, therefore, triggered coverage. And like many such disputes, these coverage disputes have ended up being litigated in the courts, and there have been varying results across the country. So let's start with some successful arguments against coverage. In other words, where carriers have been successful in denying claims. One of the most prominent arguments against coverage lies in the overarching view that business interruption policies are intended to indemnify an insured for loss caused by physical disruption to the property. For example, a fire or a hurricane. And inserting this argument, carriers have relied on policy language requiring, again, that phrase, direct physical loss and direct physical damage. And some courts have agreed with carriers, and they've interpreted this policy language as requiring physical structural damage to an insured property in order to invoke coverage. And relatedly, some courts have concluded that the virus cannot cause that physical damage. As an example, in the Southern District of New York, in the Social Life Magazine versus Central Insurance Company case, the plaintiff sued its carrier seeking coverage for business income losses related to COVID-19. In discussing the physical damage requirement, the court challenged plaintiff's argument that the virus, like a mold, can damage property that it lands on. And there, the court noted that any damage that's caused by the virus, even on surfaces, damages people. It doesn't damage the property itself. And as the court put it, the virus damages lungs, not printing presses. As a corollary, the carrier noted that unlike the case of toxic fumes, here, there was absolutely nothing that would prevent the owner of a business from entering their property to, for example, collect mail or conduct basic office functions. And this view was recently echoed in the Sixth Circuit, which applied Ohio law in the case Santos Italian Cafe versus Acuity Insurance Company. There, too, the Sixth Circuit affirmed a coverage denial based on the same principle. The court found no direct physical loss or damage because the restaurant itself was not tangibly destroyed. And the court specifically noted that the owner in that case could still use every inch of the space, even if not for dining purposes. Now, notably, in that case, the restaurant did not argue that the virus physically and directly altered the property. And that's something that has been argued in other cases that we're going to talk about, and in some cases successfully argued before certain courts. Now, in interpreting policy language, courts have often relied on the explicit and plain language of the policy. And as one court observed in terms of the direct physical loss and damage requirement, the words direct and physical both modify loss and damage. And the court determined that because both those words modify loss and damage, that requires any loss or damage to be actual. In other words, has to be an actual change to the property. Now, other courts have looked to the policy as a whole for guidance. And many business interruption policies refer to a period of restoration. Now, construing a contract as a whole, then, and using those basic contract interpretation principles, Courts have found that this language, this period of restoration language to be specific, bolsters the position that a physical loss, as stated in the policy, requires actual physical damage. And in fact, the Eighth Circuit, which is the first circuit court to rule on COVID-19 related business interruption claims, partially relied on policy language providing a period of restoration when determining that coverage did not exist for a plaintiff's COVID-19 related claim. Again, however, in that case, the plaintiff did not allege that the virus had physically and directly altered the property. So although there have been many courts across the country that have denied business interruption coverage based on this direct physical loss language, some courts have not denied coverage, at least at the motion to dismiss stage. So turning to successful arguments in favor of coverage, we can look to courts in North Carolina, Virginia, and Missouri, among some other ones, that have construed the direct physical loss requirement in a way that could provide coverage for COVID-19 claims. Now, turning again to the plain language of the contract, some courts have looked at the dual phrases, direct physical loss and direct physical damage, and determined that while that term damage might require structural change, the term loss might not. Specifically, in North Delhi State versus the Cincinnati Insurance Company, that court actually granted partial summary judgment in favor of the plaintiff and concluded that the business interruption policy afforded coverage for COVID-19 related losses. And that court applied contract principles, which require each word or phrase in a contract to have meaning. So that policy provided coverage for direct physical loss or direct physical damage. And so while the court explained that while physical damage might require structural alteration to the property, physical loss must mean something different. Because if it doesn't, then that phrase would be rendered meaningless. And under that contract interpretation, every word and phrase must be assigned a specific meaning. Now, other courts have similarly found a more expansive definition of direct physical loss. And those courts have determined that physical loss can occur absent tangible structural damage if the property becomes uninhabitable, inaccessible, and dangerous to use. And one example of a court making this finding is a district court for the Eastern District of Virginia, an Elegant Massage versus State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company. In that case, the court denied in part the insurance company's motion to dismiss the plaintiff's complaint, which of course had challenged a denial of coverage for losses stemming from the pandemic. Now, in addressing the question of direct physical loss, as an initial matter, the court recognized that direct physical loss was not defined in the policy. And therefore, using policy interpretation principles, the court concluded that they would construe the phrase in a way to provide or to favor coverage. And the court construed direct physical loss to mean that the property is uninhabitable, inaccessible, or dangerous because of intangible or non-structural sources. And the court there analogized the presence of the coronavirus to cases where courts did find a direct physical loss where asbestos, ammonia, or toxic gas had rendered a property uninhabitable, inaccessible, or dangerous. So in that case, the court was drawing an analogy between the presence of the coronavirus and the presence of asbestos, ammonia, or other toxic gas. And that's a distinction that we didn't see in other courts where they concluded that the physical presence of COVID-19 was just not sufficient to reach that standard. Now, a similar argument that has also been successful is that COVID-19 does in fact cause physical damage to the property. Turning back to our New York case, these cases would reject the proposition that COVID-19 does not in fact damage the printing presses. So this argument was made successfully in the Western District of Missouri in the Studio 417 case, Studio 417 versus Cincinnati Insurance Company. There, the plaintiffs alleged a causal relationship between COVID-19 and their losses, and they further alleged that COVID-19 is a physical substance that lives on and is active on inert physical surfaces. And further, the plaintiffs alleged that when COVID-19 attaches itself to the property, it damaged their property, and that damaged property made their premises unsafe and unusable. And that court determined that those allegations were sufficient to survive a motion to dismiss. Now, of course, whether those allegations will be provable and sufficient to survive a motion for summary judgment or even in trial is another question. But the court did determine that it was sufficient to survive the motion to dismiss. So what is the difference in these outcomes from different courts? Well, to some extent, there's some artful pleading. In other words, through trial and error, plaintiffs have honed in on the most effective ways to survive a motion to dismiss. Plaintiffs alleging not just causational losses, but alleging the presence of COVID-19 on their property, which does in fact cause physical damage. But more importantly, I think these different outcomes largely come down to jurisdictional approaches to the direct physical loss requirement, with some jurisdictions historically taking a wider view than others. And we can look directly to that Virginia case where they're creating that analogy between the coronavirus and asbestos, ammonia, and toxic gas. And so these varied approaches have been troubling to observers and to our government. And for that reason, governments are considering legislation to address coverage for business interruption caused by COVID-19. But before we move on to discuss a brief discussion on legislation, we need to touch on one more aspect of the policy that has been heavily litigated, and that is the virus exclusion. So as I mentioned at the beginning of my presentation, many of these policies are subject to certain exclusions. And so what is an exclusion? Well, a policy exclusion is a policy that carves out and eliminates coverage under certain circumstances. Might see drawing parallel here to force majeure, right? And one policy exclusion that has received a lot of attention recently is what some are referring to as the virus exclusion. Now, if we step back in time to 2003, when the world saw a SARS outbreak, many insurers at that point in time introduced exclusion clauses related to communicable diseases, epidemics, and pandemics. And as always, policy language is going to vary based on the policy. But typically, the language excluding these types of losses will read something to the effect of that losses are going to be excluded when caused directly or indirectly by a virus or bacteria or communicable disease. Now, what does this mean? Well, this means that even if a plaintiff is able to successfully plead or establish the required direct physical loss under the policy, coverage might still be denied based on a virus exclusion, which would preclude coverage. So what are some of the key arguments surrounding litigation concerning that virus exclusion? Well, again, arguments are going to vary greatly depending on the language of the virus exclusion at issue. And many courts have upheld an exclusion based on the plain language of the policy. In other words, if a policy excludes coverage for losses caused directly or indirectly by a virus, coverage is often precluded. However, there have been a few arguments that have succeeded in defeating the application of the exclusion in favor of coverage. First is invalidity of anti-concurrent causation clauses. So what is an anti-concurrent causation clause? An anti-concurrent causation clause, the clauses indicate that if a loss is caused by a combination of covered and excluded causes, the cause of loss is not going to be covered. In other words, when a loss is caused by both covered and excluded causes, the loss will not be covered, regardless of whether the covered cause of loss was the proximate cause. Certain jurisdictions do not recognize these clauses and instead apply the efficient proximate cause doctrine. And that doctrine states that when a loss is caused by a combination of a covered and an excluded risk, the loss will be covered if the covered risk was the efficient proximate cause of the loss. And what does that mean? Well, the precise definition can vary by jurisdiction, but generally, the efficient proximate cause is going to be the primary driving force. On the flip side, if the covered risk is only a remote cause of loss, then the loss isn't going to be covered. Now, this argument was successfully made in the California Superior Court very recently to defeat Demur in the Frantic versus Certain Underwriters at Lloyd's London case. Now, there, the band Metallica sued its carrier for a breach of their cancellation, abandonment, and non-appearance insurance based on a denial of coverage for several canceled concerts. Now, the carrier there relied on the virus exclusion, which stated that it would not cover any loss directly or indirectly arising out of any communicable disease. And the court denied the carrier's demur and concluded that the plaintiff had adequately alleged that the tours were canceled because of covered causes. And those covered causes included travel restrictions, the duty to mitigate damages, and the need to flatten the curve. And in this case, because the plaintiff had adequately alleged that coronavirus was not the efficient proximate cause of the show's cancellations, the lawsuit was permitted to proceed. Now, I have to note that this argument depends heavily on the pleadings, because in the Ninth Circuit, very recently affirmed a coverage denial based on the virus exclusion. And so there, applying the efficient proximate cause doctrine, the court agreed with the carrier that the cause of the plaintiff's losses was the virus and not government orders. And therefore, that virus exclusion did apply. So like so many things that we're talking about here, you have to very carefully look at the language of the policy and also the language of the pleadings when determining whether these exclusions are going to apply or not. Now, a second related argument is that the plain language of the virus exclusion requires the virus to be the immediate cause of loss. So again, for this analysis, we're looking at plain language and causation. And we'll turn back to our Elegant Massage case in the Eastern District of Virginia. In that case, the court determined that the virus exclusion was not applicable based on the plain language of the policy. Now, the exclusion there was a little bit different than the one in California. The exclusion here, or in Virginia, concerned the growth, proliferation, spread, or presence of virus, bacteria, or other organisms that induce or is capable of inducing physical distress, illness, or disease. Now, that policy also stated that it would cover remediation costs for removal of a virus or bacteria or fungi. So the court there determined that based on the plain language of the policy and construing the policy as a whole, as we've seen courts do throughout this program, the exclusion would apply where a virus had spread throughout the property. But as I talked about artful pleading, in this case, the plaintiff alleged that their cause of loss was the government shutdown order requiring the business's closure, and not the presence of the virus. Now, in that case, the carrier did point out the connection between the virus and the losses, but the court found that the connection had to be direct. And because the plaintiff had not alleged that losses stemmed from the presence of the virus at the covered property, or that the virus had directly caused loss and instead relied on the shutdown orders, the court allowed the litigation to proceed. So what is the punchline here? As you can see, the outcome of any particular coverage case will be highly dependent not only on the language of the policy, but also on local jurisprudence and on artful pleading. And so all of this uncertainty has prompted legislators to step in to try to find a legislative solution. And at this point in time, multiple states are considering bills that would require insurers to provide business interruption coverage for COVID-19 related claims, irrespective of exclusions or other language. And on a federal level, the Pandemic Risk Insurance Act was very recently reintroduced. It was actually reintroduced this month. And that act would require insurance companies to offer non-damage business interruption insurance policies that would cover a pandemic. The bill would also create a pandemic risk reinsurance program to ensure that there's sufficient capacity to cover these losses in the event of a resurgence of COVID-19 or future pandemics. Now, obviously, this type of legislation will pose many challenges. And as an initial matter, requiring coverage for these losses would impose a significant burden on the insurance carriers. While many of these bills do provide a pathway for state or federal reimbursement, there are still many questions about constitutionality. First, the proposed retroactivity would effectively rewrite existing policies and therefore be ripe for constitutional challenges from insurers who are forced to pay for risks which they say they never intended to cover. So one potential challenge might be under the taking clause, and another potential challenge might be under the contract clause. And while particularly under the contract clause, which provides that no state shall pass any laws that impair the obligation of contracts, while it might sound like there's strong footing for carriers here, the clause is balanced with the state's police power to safeguard the vital interests of its people. So there is much uncertainty in this landscape, but the outcome of any such legislation and challenges are going to have huge impacts on the insurance industry going forward. So kind of looking forward and stepping back, businesses, I believe, should carefully pay attention to not only how their jurisdiction is interpreting these policies, but also how the language of business interruption policies going forward might change. It's likely that business interruption policies will be revised to include explicit exclusions which unambiguously address COVID-19. Now, on the flip side, there's also the possibility that some carriers are going to pair that with offers of endorsements for future shutdowns that might be caused by COVID-19 or a similar pandemic. So to wrap things up for me, COVID-19 continues to cause major disruptions to businesses throughout the country and throughout the world. And many businesses are fighting on two fronts, not only to be excused from contractual obligations that they're simply unable to meet, but they're also struggling to recoup the money that's lost due to the impact of the pandemic. And I'm going to pass it over to Tejian for a few final words on force majeure before we say goodbye to you.
Thank you, Joanna. That was very detailed and very informative. And just as a final note, and it kind of ties into, you know, what's going on with the business interruption insurance, force majeure and business interruption really seems to hinge upon the contractual language and the pleadings. And, you know, like I said, when it comes to force majeure pre-COVID and post-COVID, causation and the causation, the effects of causation on standard of contract performance really play or really are at the forefront of determining whether or not courts are awarding plaintiffs relief from liability from non-performance. So just as a tip, as a contracting drafting tip, when you are drafting contracts for your clients or when we draft contracts for our clients, we typically like to focus on the nature of the business of the parties, the scope of the contract. We try to consider things that may come about that are beyond the control of the parties, as well as some things that may be unforeseeable. And we include that language broadly, as well as within the catch-all provisions of the contract to ensure that, or to ensure to the best of our ability, that things are thought out to the extent as best possible. So just to conclude, just pay attention to these force majeure contracts. Pay attention to the scope of the contract. Make sure that the intent of the parties is communicated within the scope of your force majeure provision. And I think that's it for me, Joanna.
All right. Fantastic, Adrian. It's just from my end, as I said, cases are continuing to weave their way through the courts right now, and businesses and insurance carriers are closely monitoring their actions. At this point, the 9th, the 6th, and the 8th circuits have all ruled. They've actually ruled against coverage. But to some extent, these wins have been fact-specific and very case-specific. So it still really remains to be seen how the majority of courts are going to come down. So all this legal action is still being monitored very, very closely. I want to conclude by thanking you for joining us today. I hope that you found the presentation informative. We are happy to answer any questions that you might have via email, and I hope that you all have a wonderful rest of your day. Be well, and thank you again for joining us.